Hi, my name is Nathan Young, and this is Uncommon.
Uncommon is a production by Neural, an agency that helps both brands and talent tell their story. To learn more, just visit neural.com. That's NERALLE.com. My guest this week is Nathan Young, co-founder of Pear. Thanks for coming in, mate.
Thanks for having me.
I know you have just in the nick of time injured your back bouldering last night.
Yeah.
But you must have, I got to say, learnt a few things about injuries and bouncing back from old mate Jackie Chan as his assistant.
Yeah.
What was that like as one of your first jobs?
Yeah, so I started working for Jackie Chan when I just graduated, and I was in Beijing. It was quite an interesting experience because I knew nothing about like the movie world.
Yeah.
And getting to work almost side by side with him was quite exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is he a mainlander or is he originally from Hong Kong? Because most of his movies were always really Hong Kong based.
So from my knowledge, he's from Hong Kong.
Okay, he is.
And he does speak Mandarin. He works mainly in mainland now.
Of course, it's where all the money is, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I guess I was lucky enough to speak all three languages that he speaks. So right. I also speak Cantonese, Mandarin, and English fluently.
Wow.
So that's why I got the opportunity to go to France with him to the Cannes Film Festival.
Wow.
In my first year working for him.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and I was kind of like the schedule assistant, just trying to make sure he's being at events on time. And just constantly worrying that he's going to miss that. And he doesn't care. He doesn't care he's late or not. But yeah. I care. So that's my job there.
Yeah. He's Jackie Chan. He can do whatever he wants, man.
Yeah.
That would be really, really fascinating. I remember, God, do you remember when there was like that meme that went through the internet that Jackie Chan had died? Do you remember that?
It was a big thing.
Like, it was sort of like the early era of like misinformation. And that was like one of the first things that went through the internet like crazy that was just completely wrong.
Oh, wow.
I remember this really, really well because like people were making all these memes about it, but it just started like on 4chan or Reddit or something like that. And it was like people showing that they could just persuade the media to run stories when they had no like source or like confirmation of it.
Yeah.
And he was like the next, because, you know, he was like asleep or something and he just like came on social media and he's like, hey guys, I'm alive.
And I guess it would totally make sense because, you know, he's always filming these dangerous moves.
Yeah.
And people just believe in that.
It was like a very like benign thing. Like he passed away in his sleep or something. So people were just like really surprised, but I was like, there's something iffy about this.
So
I don't know when that was. It must have been like 2015.
I totally missed the meme.
Something like 2015 or maybe a little bit earlier. Because I know you were there. You worked there like 2013?
Yeah, I was working there from 2012 to 2013.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because looking at your career, it's quite an interesting one so far. I mean, Kerry Grammer, Bachelor of Arts in Creative Writing at Melbourne Uni. Straight out the gate, you're working with Jackie Chan at his foundation. So you worked initially as an assistant, then editor, producer. Then you went into, is it Shaanxi province?
Yes.
In China. So you worked there for a good 6 months as a producer, then independent for a couple of years. I was just curious from all of that time where you were building this knowledge, what seemed like the principle or what seems like the principle you pulled from that time of your life to Pear today?
Well, yeah, it's been a long journey, I guess. When I did my bachelor's, I also did film studies and creative writing in Melbourne at University of Melbourne.
Yeah.
And I guess at the time, my dream was to get into the film industry, be a director or screenwriter. That's why I did creative writing. Uh-huh. And that's why I worked for Jackie Chan. But I guess throughout working in the industry, seeing all these productions up close, I felt that it's actually not my passion.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so it's almost like a realization that I might not like this as much as I thought I would.
Wow.
And so I tried different things, as you can see. I tried to do TV, tried to do, you know, a bit of production. I also went independent and made my own documentary, which also got a few awards in some international film festivals.
Nice.
But then after all of that, I was like certain, all right, film is actually not my passion. And so I came back to Australia and started doing these small advertisement productions which I found I have a much more passion for.
Okay.
Because I guess I've always had a passion for advertisement. It's weird. But yeah, and ever since, you know, I've been doing marketing, advertising videos for commercial purposes.
Yeah.
And I guess I've always been an entrepreneur by heart. It probably came from my family.
Right, okay.
And I always wanted to do my own thing. And I guess that's partly why I joined Brossa, just to learn up close, you know, at the front row, to see how a startup can scale from 10 to 100 employees.
So your parents, what did they do when you were growing up?
So my dad was always an entrepreneur.
Okay.
He's from Hong Kong. He ran a couple of different businesses back in the days. And since the financial crisis has hit Hong Kong, he sort of went down from there.
Yeah, right.
And it's a really interesting story, because he actually has three rules for me and my brothers.
Okay.
Yeah. One is never gamble.
Okay.
Two is never get into the stock market.
Okay.
Because he used to run these, you know, like financial firms.
Okay.
And financial crisis hit and it was pretty bad for him.
Yeah.
And the third one is never start your own company.
Because, really?
Because it's such a big risk.
Wow.
And his hope, because, you know, that's how he lost everything pretty much. He had his own company. He was in finance. He was in stock market. And he lost everything because of he did all these things.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think none of our brothers took it. Yeah. None of the brothers followed his rules. We were all just entrepreneur by heart.
Yeah. So when you say the financial crisis, you mean like the GFC 2008-09, or do you mean the recent?
I was like, I think it was 79,
89. Oh, okay. So you're talking about the Asian financial crisis.
Hong Kong financial crisis.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So.
But that's like history.
It is. No, but that would have been, like for a lot of people in Asia, like it affected pretty much every Asian country plus Australia pretty badly. I think, so that would have been like 91, I'm pretty sure. Because I just remember my dad, his business with his brother went broke, that they bought from my grandpa, their dad, and they still never paid. They went broke. They owed him money, and he's classic like Greek immigrant. I don't want to pay tax, so just pay me like a loan. And they never paid him back the loan, or they never paid him back the amount, because the business went broke and they were having to personally pay him back. And he was, you know, he gave him good terms or whatever, but he died before they could even pay him back. And like for my dad and my uncle, like that was a really defining moment, because I was born basically just before that crisis.
Mm.
And so dad was working like 14, 15 hour days. And he, very similar thing to your dad. He's like, was it the other day? He was like, oh, you know, you always want to maintain like a salary job. You can do this, you can do that. And like, it's just one of those things that you have like innately where you can't control it. You just want to do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's really funny that you mentioned that, because I feel like I've got something similar there.
Yeah, it's very funny.
It is, but it's also one of those things where your parents tell you not to do something and then you just want to do it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. It's one of those things.
So you had that, I guess, growing up as a kid. So that would have been in the back of your mind. Mm. I'm curious with these studies, you went sort of, I think it was 2015 I had here. So you'd sort of got that entrepreneurial bug still. You were sort of finding what you were wanting to do. You sort of settled on textiles, I think. There's a few clothing brands. So there was T-Rex Melbourne, the Sew Project. And then in between that, you were sort of working at Brosa as well in a full-time position. When you think about those projects, because I've had a similar thing where we've gone through two different iterations or ideas before getting to Neural and Uncommon. What do you see in hindsight was like the thing that you learned from that period in particular that's helped with Pear now? Because there's always something that you'll just fail on or waste time on in particular.
Yeah, totally. I feel like there was a lot, obviously. T-Rex was the first thing, you know, that I've ever started with my friend Rex again.
So
Rex has been the same co-founder throughout all my projects.
That's cool, man.
Because we've known each other since uni and we've been best friends since.
Yeah, yeah.
So we always wanted to do something together. And I guess T-Rex is one of the ones that we learned so much from, because it's the first, and the first is always where you get to know everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, from zero to one is, there's just so much to it. I mean, I feel like you learn that you just got to get things done. You just, you know, you can't compromise on little things. You have to keep it going, keep the momentum.
Was there little things you found that you wasted a lot of time on? Like, I'll give you an example for us. Our first business was in 3D printing. It was with my partner, Lauren, and two others. And we wasted so much time on the shareholder agreement that the thing never even really got off because we were just wasting our time. And I'd learnt by then that the two other people we were founding the business with, I did not want to work with them.
Uh-huh.
So for me, that was a very good lesson in choose your founders wisely and don't fluff around with things like NDAs and shareholder agreements. It's just a waste of time.
I feel like we've definitely been through that. I think that's what a lot of beginners, I mean, startup entrepreneurs will go through, is you spend too much time on paperwork.
Pretty much,
way
yeah.
too much time sorting out the IP, sorting out, you know, making sure everything's proper.
Perfect.
Yeah. And it never goes to plan anyway.
Nothing on actually making product or selling it or anything.
But one other thing I learned from T-Rex and Soul Project actually is, because I come from sort of a background of graphic design as well. I do graphic design and video production. And I would think that, because I do graphic design, I should be able to also design T-shirts, which is completely wrong. And we actually did spend or wasted so much time designing clothes, which did not work out well.
Yeah, but if you think about it, going through that process would have taught you what the process actually is.
Yes.
So when you finally got to a moment where at least by then you had a really decent product worth doing, when it came to the research and production stage, you would have been clued in.
Yeah. The most valuable thing we learned was the process of prototyping and working with factories.
Yeah.
Especially when you work with Chinese factories. There's so many processes that you wouldn't know if you never started doing it, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, knowing the measurements, knowing the materials, knowing what's the best way to explain things to them, even that was really valuable from my past experiences.
In textiles, what's the dominant region for textiles in China?
I would say it's like the mid part of China, like around Shanghai.
Which province is that?
It's like Jiangsu and Zhejiang.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's not... Because it's sort of like there is that dominant province in China, but also India's got a really dominant province for things like leather, as an example, because we've got a family member who has a handbag company.
Mm.
So there's always sort of, when it comes to textiles or like my dad in printing, there's like a dominant area for paper.
Mm. I guess with textile and China, the biggest advantage that China has in textile industry is the entire supply chain. It does everything from the crops to the yarn to any material you need and then to the final product. Like they do the whole thing. And even if they don't do it in that province, it's so close. It's like 1 hour, 2 hours away to ship something over.
Yeah.
They've got the entire supply chain sorted.
Yeah. They're the dominant integrated manufacturing capital of the world. There's no doubt about it.
That's why, you know, even though people are talking about, you know, moving production to Bangladesh, Vietnam and Thailand, they still can't compete with China on the supply chain.
Yeah.
It's like they're good with the final and, you know, the assembly part, like sewing things together, but they don't really source all of that materials from close by provinces.
Yeah, yeah. We've had a good chat actually with, there's a company called Saucy. I don't know if you've heard of them, but they're another challenger brand. They're basically like a full service sort of agency where they handle everything to do with building a new product. Like, let's say you had an idea and you came to them for a pair for initially testing it. They just do everything. Like, they've got 30 people in China, they've got like 20 people in India, and they've got a pretty good understanding of supply chains and where it's all at. They said the same thing. The reality is that there's certain things you just cannot get out of China, like plastics and microprocessors. You cannot do anything with those products outside of China. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
But the supply chain element is very interesting. They said it's going to take a long, long time because businesses like theirs need to exist where they're able to split out the supply chain and act as sort of the the operator that would exist in China,
mm.
pull everything together and pull all the right people and the right products and all that and move it into the right place.
Yeah.
But that is very complicated. And it's going to take like a decade or two before that changes.
Yeah,
so
totally is.
For the moment, you're right. It will be...
China probably spent the last 30, 40 years building that supply chain.
Yeah.
Right? And...
easily, you know, since the 90s.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's across the entire China. It's not just that area.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So... okay, so you would have obviously learned a lot about production, product, wasting time. I was curious, at Brosa, you would have, like you said, you wanted to learn, wanted to learn more about how a company goes from, I think it was 10 to 100,
yep.
you mentioned. The intro came via Rich. He did mention about Pear when he was in. I think you started at Brosa about 2018? Or is it earlier?
I would say end of 2015, actually.
Oh, right. Okay.
Pretty early.
What was your first impression of Rich? I don't know if he was still working there at the time.
Yeah, he was, of course. I mean, I knew Rich back in uni. And we actually had our first ever entrepreneurial project together, which is in 2008. We went to see the Olympics, like the torch thing going around in Canberra. And me and Rich, we teamed up. We decided to print our own T-shirts and we just sold them at the parade. And we sold like $20 T-shirts. We printed like 200 of them. It took us 3 days, day and night, just hand printing, We did it all ourselves. We got two other mates to help, but we designed the whole T-shirt. We cut the screen print thing and we bought the ink, the paint, and we just like hand screen printed everything, 200 t-shirts.
Wow.
And you know, we made a couple of $100, really not that much.
Yeah, yeah.
But we got the experience, you know. And then we went to Sydney for a trip and spent all the money just on traveling and having fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a really great experience with Rich. And you know, ever since we've been pretty good friends. And I think when he started Brosa, you know, I think 1 year later, he asked me to join. That's 2015.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And he is always a very fast, efficient, problem-solving type of person.
Yeah.
He's always really sensitive with opportunities. And, you know, that's something I'm always learning from him. And, yeah.
When you say sensitive, as in, what do you mean by that?
I mean, he can always... almost like a natural instinct that he can sense an opportunity.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's very aware.
He's very aware. Yeah. That's a better word.
Yeah, I think even the other day I had like a quick Zoom call with him. He just, he cuts through bullshit really quickly.
Yes, exactly.
That's the thing that I've noticed about
him. That's what I like about him.
Yeah, he's just, I think what it comes from is the fact that like the guy had a really interesting upbringing and he's like, he's just a real old fashioned like, operator.
Yeah, definitely.
I was reading this book the other day about like cable cowboys, like how the cable industry started out. And there's always this reference to like the hatchet man, like the guy who just gets shit done. And that's how I see Rich.
Yeah.
You know, like he will take a cloudy, nefarious idea and literally like put it into like the perfect structure, plan, whatever it may be, and just like get it done.
Similar
thing that Lauren has actually for me, because I can talk about something at a big idea, but she's the one that obviously translates it to actual creative work.
Yeah, I would say the one most important lesson I learned from Richard is that he's a doer.
Yeah.
He does things. He does then talk.
Yeah.
So every time we were, you know, you can talk about ideas and startups for hours and hours. Richard just gets it done in the first minute. He starts actioning on things in like within 5 minutes.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, like I said, we had this call and he just gave me like, okay, here's the four things you need to think about and that's it. And it's like the conversation was like 10 minutes. I'm like, oh, cool, sick. Because I allocated like 30 minutes in the meeting and I was like, sweet, I've got everything I need. And I like that. I like it when people cut through fluff.
Yeah.
So Pear, founded while still working at Brosa. D2C brand, you've taken a funding round, build yourself, but it's not just you, I guess. Some of the investors like Rich calling it the comfiest socks in the world. I know the initial story is that you were frustrated with getting holes in your socks, and I don't know why, but I never thought about this because I have the same issue.
Oh,
constant fucking holes in socks. And the best socks that you can buy that I found are either some, at least for guys, like some brand, I can't remember the brand, but something from Maya or DJs, but again, they just break real quickly.
Mm.
Or you go to like a really fancy shoe store, like a Double Monk, and you, but then you get these real thin sort of materials and they're just too slippery, they're too delicate. There's always some sort of issue. So you've sort of got this, you've actually trademarked it, actually, the Supreme Cool Blend, 50-50 wool cotton.
Yes.
Which I thought was very smart. Tell us about those initial days of discovery with the manufacturer in Germany.
Yes. Yeah, so as you might know, I surf quite a bit, and whenever we surf, we often like to camp near the beach.
Okay.
And it's super cold. You often get up in super cold mornings and you want to surf like the first waves.
Yeah.
And one, it's really cold, and two, if you wear like merino socks that keeps you warm, they are pretty fragile and they could break quite easily. And that's why they will get holes in it. So that's when I started to think about the concept of, can we make better socks?
Mm-hmm.
And the moment you start thinking about it, you start discovering all these other problems you have with socks.
Yeah.
Like it often stinks, right?
Yeah.
Like everyone's socks will stink.
Yeah.
And no one ever thought about, can we make socks that don't stink?
Yeah.
You know, they often absorb the sweat and they get a bit, you know, saggy, sweaty. It's disgusting.
Like immediately.
Yeah, immediately, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, often they are really cold, of course. That's one of the biggest problems. You get holes in them. They're not comfortable when you walk or run, you know, they don't have enough padding often. Or they, like ankle socks that I often wear, they don't stay in space. They just often keep slipping down your heels.
Yeah, fucking hell.
That is one of the biggest problems, like when you start thinking about socks. So I guess that's when I started to think like, hey, there's actually so many pain points in socks. Why don't we just redesign the whole thing?
Mm.
And when we started to think about redesigning it, obviously warmth and the stinking issue is one of the biggest problems that... One of the difficult problems, I would say, to solve, because it's within the material itself.
Okay.
Right? So if you're going with cotton socks, it's never going to solve the problem, because cotton is naturally, you know, it is what it is, right?
Mm.
But if you go with pure merino socks, which kind of does solve the stinking problem and the warmth problem, but as I said, it's a very fragile fiber, so it can break easily. Sometimes it's too thin, you know. So we looked at the possibility of blending wool and cotton. That's when the concept came along.
Okay. Who thought of that? Was it the manufacturer? Was it you guys? Was it?
So, Mike, you know, we were talking about the Chinese supply chain for a while just now. I'm actually really lucky to team up with Rex, my co-founder.
Yeah, that's right.
So he actually has a family background in textile. His family has been running textile factories and companies for like 30 plus years. So he is actually very specialized and knowledgeable in all textile knowledge. So he's the one who actually consulted, you know, his dad, his friends in China, you know, the top specialists in China that in that, you know, like the king of supply chain of the of textile. And every specialist, every top specialist came back to him with the same answer. They said, you'll have to blend wool and cotton.
Really?
Yeah, and even Rex and his dad, they both came down to the same conclusion as well. They just sort of brought the question to the specialist.
Yeah, right.
And that's when we thought, all right, seems like this is the one answer we just keep getting from every specialist. But the problem is, how do we do it? It's like, no one does it at the time.
Yeah, I was really surprised about that.
Yeah,
really
at the time, surprised. No one does it. Yeah, we were surprised to find out, like, why is no one doing it, right?
Yeah.
So the more we did our research, the more we found out that, okay, it's actually technically extremely difficult to do it, because wool is animal fiber and cotton is a plant fiber.
Okay.
And plant fibers and animal fibers, they don't go hand in hand. They are almost like just rejecting each other when you try to blend them into, you know, one thread.
Yeah.
So it requires like supreme craftsmanship to really make this work.
Huh.
And then we did our research, and then we found that there is actually a workshop in Germany that can do it, which, you know, was mind-blowing for us. So we got in touch with them. You know, we sort of talked about how can this technically be done. We learned from them, and we took the idea and we came back and we developed it ourselves.
Wow. Okay. So, and because one of the things I was thinking about is this blending of the thread, because like my novice non-textile brain was like, oh, you know, they just put, if you imagine like little lines of thread, you have like a thread of wool and a thread of cotton, but no, you have to merge the physical original product into the actual thread itself. So yeah, the thread is exactly 50-50.
Yeah. So the thread itself, you know, you're blending the fiber. It's not just taking...
Yeah, the fiber.
Yeah, you're not taking a cotton thread and a wool thread and just blending them together. It's not that simple.
Yeah.
We are blending them at like a micro level.
Okay.
So technically, it's extremely hard to create. It took us months because we did it during COVID.
Yeah, I was gonna say, yeah.
It was hard to communicate with the factory to get the samples. So a lot of work actually went into the development of the yarn itself. Mm. And, you know, after months and months of developing back and forth, we finally ended up with the Supreme Cool Blend, which is a 50-50 blend.
Okay. And so that firm in Germany, would they sort of acted as like your R&D? Did you then pull, did they manufacture the bulk of the thread, or did you then pull it into somewhere like China and just spec it out?
Yeah, we pulled it into China and we spec'd it out because Rax, again, as I said, he is kind of a specialist in the textile industry already. So all we needed is a starting point, really. And we have access to labs. We have access to all the specialists that does our, that does R&D. And once they see the concept, it's just about testing and, you know, getting it done.
Yeah, and it makes sense because it's one of the things that both Rich and Ethan have spoken about every time we get someone in here and we talk about D2C, you need to own as much as possible.
Yeah. You want to own the supply chain. You want to own like your product from the material to the end.
Yeah, to the retail
experience. So, you know, you manage your cost, you know, and then you can bring the best price to your customers.
You. Yes, you. Are you intrigued by this episode? If so, go to our footer on the website, neuralle.com. We're going to give you an insight each week. It's going to be on business, marketing, or a topic that we covered in the episode at all. We'd love your support and it would help us in developing the intellect around this series. But without going on too much longer, let's get back into this episode. So I guess that was a thing that was really intriguing me is, and you can tell me if I'm being naive with this. So I would assume socks generally have a lower card value. That also means, of course, that your cost per acquisition is going to be lower. So I'm guessing there's going to be some profitability there so long as you can merge as much of the supply chain as possible. Obviously, you're an earlier business, so it's harder now than, say, 2-3 years from now. And you're still going to be able to beat out your competitors at Maya, Uniqlo, wherever people buy socks, essentially. Where does this go to, though? Because it's obvious that at some point, and it's a principle that Rich has spoken about and others, you need to expand your cart size. It's why they got into other bags and so forth. So it seems like to me in the back of my mind that what you guys are really good at is creative and R&D for thread or textile in and of itself, which then you use into new product for clothing.
Yeah. So what Pear cares the most about is comfort.
Okay.
So the first product we wanted to do is socks because we see, you know, a lot of problems with it. So we wanted to make the most comfortable socks in the world.
Okay.
And we did it with, you know, our R&D, you know, our design with all of that. But we wanted to bring that comfort to more things, like more intimate clothes, potentially loungewears, underwears, clothing, anything that brings you the idea of concept, idea of comfort.
Yeah.
And we are definitely looking into developing new products.
Okay.
But we will always leverage our advantage, which is, as you said, R&D with textile. We are always going to use natural materials, finding the most suitable materials, and we'll make them into the most comfortable products in that category that you've ever used before.
Totally, yeah. And I guess the moment you say the word comfort is something that Rich and Ethan have spoken about is you have to have a word that you want to dominate with your business, which I can't remember if they said theirs was luggage or travel. I think I'm pretty sure it was travel.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you come up with the idea or the word of comfort, did they prompt you to say that, or was that innately in the back of your mind?
We actually had debates. Like, I feel like I was the one that was trying to push the idea of comfort.
Okay.
And then, you know, our investors, you know, like Aith, Rich, or even my co-founder, Rex, they would have doubts about it because there's no one definition to comfort, right? Like, how do you define comfort?
I don't know.
Exactly. So it kind of sounds like a bit of fluff.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of sounds like it's just a bit of bullshit. But I feel like it's possible. Like, you know something is comfortable when it's comfortable.
How would you define, like, I would say content. Content plus, there's like got to be a bit of, yeah.
Yeah.
It's really hard.
It's hard to explain exactly what comfort is.
Yeah.
But if it's comfort, you know it's comfort, right? So I guess when I look at a product and when I want to bring the most comfortable version of it to the customers, I would actually try to break the idea of concept down as much as I can. For example, with socks, it's like, it has to fit just right. It has to be soft. It has to be warm. It has to not rub against any of your skin, you know, that's irritating. So it's like, it's really detailed feelings that you get that builds up or combines into one big concept.
Yeah.
Comfort.
Yeah. It's almost like perfect, but content, like, but it's not one or the other. So it's you got to define it on each product.
Yeah. So every product, you will have a different definition for comfort.
Mm.
And we look at every aspect of it and try to solve every problem.
But, you know, you also may, 2 years from now, you also may have that definition. So you don't know, because you're still in that very early stage. And like I said, socks is probably just the beginning.
Yeah.
I guess I'm curious then, you know, when you think about go-to-market and where you guys are at, I think I read somewhere you've sold 10,000, or maybe it was even the brand sort of PR scoop thing that you sent through, 10,000 pairs of socks since launch. So launch was November last year.
Yep.
There's obviously a market fit here. What's the current, like, go-to-market strategy that you guys have?
So right now, we are mostly using Facebook.
Okay.
If that's what you're asking.
Yeah.
Yeah, Facebook advertisement, which, you know, goes over to Instagram. And that's been doing pretty well for us.
Yeah.
We explain, you know, the unique point of differences that we can bring to the market. And customers see it, they like it. But I think the main thing we do run right now is we give a free pair to anyone. So anyone who wants to just try out our socks, we give them a free pair. It's called a mystery sock.
Okay.
You get to choose the size, but we just pick the color and the type of socks you get.
Okay.
And we just send it to you. You pay the shipping, which is, you know, not that much.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, they will just claim that one free pair. They try it on, they love it, they come back for 10 pairs.
Okay.
And our socks are averaging at $20 per pair.
Yeah.
So 10 pairs already give you an AOV of 200.
Okay.
You know, even if you're buying 5 pairs, 6 pairs, you know, it's quite a decent amount.
Yeah,
and
right.
A lot of people love it so much that they will just buy for their families, for their friends. They'll buy for gifts. Because our product is something really special that you will have to experience it to know why it's good, to know the value of
it. Yeah, yeah. But it's also not too much of a hard decision to buy a 10 pair. That's really interesting. So the AOV of 200, wow.
Okay. Yeah, so we want as many people as possible to try our socks on.
Yeah.
It's something that you can't really explain or communicate through advertisement, words, even visuals. You just have to feel it, touch it, and put it on your feet and then go like, wow, this is so comfortable.
Yeah. When did you realize that was the way to, like, as a loss leader to initially bring people?
I guess even before we launched, that was one of the strategies we thought of, because the moment we had the samples in our hands, we knew it's something that you can't explain. The feeling of comfort is something you can't explain with words.
Mm.
It's something emotional. You have to wear it and feel it and then love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, the moment we had our samples in our hand, we knew this is a great product.
Yeah.
We knew people would love it. We knew this is going to be spread by the word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought, if the acquisition cost is one pair of socks, we can totally afford it, because we are so confident that people will come back and buy more.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of obvious, isn't it, now that you sold 10,000 plus.
Yeah, I guess it works out. Well, it was still quite a relief to see it work out. But still, you know, before we launched it, we were so confident in the product.
Mm.
Yeah, that I guess the go-to-market strategy was always to get people to come back and buy more, return customers.
How do you think that'll change in the way that you get that initial loss leader or customer in? Because with July, I remember my customer experience, I've got Zoe who'd started working there and I was like, okay, cool. This is obviously a good product. So there's a point of authority there. I met Ethan. Then I was like, okay, I need to go see this thing. So I went into the retail store. This is back when they're in, Emporium. So I went there, checked it out. I was like, okay, I know what I'm getting. I'm going to buy it. Do you think that would change? Would that add much value to your customer experience to help you sell more? Or do you think the current model of the free sock, free pair, the mystery sock, mystery box?
Mystery sock.
I like that. That's cool.
Yeah.
So you got the mystery sock. And that, to me, seems like it can scale infinitely. Then you just need to run more ads. You need to get more word of mouth, whatever it may be. Do you think that adding a retail component is going to help scale it further?
With our product value or order value, it doesn't seem logical yet to have our own brand retail store. Mm. But we are talking to wholesalers or boutique stores.
Okay.
Actually, quite a few boutique stores reached out to us and they wanted to stock our products.
Yeah, right.
So we are in conversation with some of those stores, so people can actually get a touch of it offline and just buy it in store.
And what's your view on that? Do you think it's a necessity? Do you think it's hard because you want to be able to control that whole experience?
I wouldn't worry about it affecting the experience per se, because our experience only starts when you're wearing the sock. And if you love it, if you bought one pair in store, you know, you save the shipping and you might come online and buy like our packs, because we sell, you know, 5 packs, 10 packs, 12 packs, and you get a slight discount on that. And you also get, you know, some discount codes for return customers if you put in a review and something.
Yeah, yeah.
So we do these little things to attract customers to come back.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Rex, this is the man who knows everything about thread counts and
product exactly. Totally. He's the man behind the product.
Like you mentioned before, he's come from this family business. He's got all this experience. You guys have worked with each other on multiple businesses now, which I would say is, you know, stronger than most relationships these days. Like, that's pretty rare to be multiple co-founders with someone.
Yep.
How did the two of you meet and what's he taught you so far about business?
So we met in first year of uni.
Okay.
Melbourne uni, yep. We were both on the debating team. That's how we met. We used to just debate each other and all debate together.
Yeah.
We went to international competitions together. And, you know, as a team, I guess, in any sport or game, you form this sort of relationship that's stronger than friends or brothers, I guess.
Mm.
And we knew each other really well, you know, and that's how we sort of became the best friends.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing he told me, I guess, that was really important is being able to communicate with other people. Because I'm more of an introvert.
Really?
Yeah. You sound surprised. I am more of an introvert deep down. But, you know, like today, you can't tell, because I guess I've learned so much from Rex. He's more of an extrovert, that he's really good at socializing, talking to people and making deals, negotiating. He does most of that, actually.
Really?
I'm more of a thinker.
Okay.
Like, behind the scene. And I just love planning and designing ads and doing marketing strategies, branding. Like, that's what I do. But Rex is the one that's going out and talking to people usually.
Okay.
So, yeah, I guess I got that a lot from him.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's... it's a good thing to have. That maybe that's why it's worked so well.
Yeah.
Because when I think about it, my partner and I, she's introverted, I'm extroverted. And I think because of that, it means that you don't step on each other's toes.
Yeah.
And I think Ethan and Rich have that as well.
Yeah.
I've noticed there's just got to be this dynamic between the two of you. If you've got two co-founders where one can do one thing and one can do another, and you can't exist without the other.
Yeah, I think that's what worked well for us. As you said, you know, we look after different things. So Rex is an expert in supply chain production, which is something I have completely no knowledge of before I started working with him. And, you know, I specialize in marketing, you know, visuals, branding, creatives, which, again, Rex doesn't really have experience of.
Mm.
And we stay in our own lanes, 100%. I remember the other day, like, a friend was joking about how come I only see Rex pick and packing in the early days. He's the one that's picking, packing the socks and then delivering it no matter how busy we are. We sold like 10,000 pairs in the first month. I did not help with any of those pairs. I did not pack anything.
Yeah, right.
So that was just like one little example that we don't step into each other's lanes, even though he's like being smashed. He's like staying up till like early in the morning sometimes just to pack for the next day's delivery.
Yeah, right.
We have so many orders coming through and I'm just... yeah, staying in the back, just doing my own things, like
making ads.
Yeah, and you know,
sending him more work.
I remember there were like one or two times I would look at him and go like, "Do you want help? Because obviously I can help you get the delivery sorted." He's like, "No, don't worry about it. I'll get it sorted." Yeah. So to a point, he will ask his parents to come and help.
No,
and he wouldn't get me to help. So that's how we work. You know, there are also, of course, there are also times that I've been smashed with like the website, with the creatives. Like sometimes I work till really, really late and then Rex will just go to sleep like 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
So yeah, I guess we don't step into each other's lanes, and personality wise, we're also like a really good, you know, fit. So it's what's more important. You know, you want to start a business with someone you trust, you know, and yeah, you have a good dynamic with.
Yeah, good dynamic. Sort of just gels together.
Yeah.
Bit of yin and yang, I always
definitely.
Say. So when it comes to, not the future, but where things go from here, you've obviously raised that initial seed round. You've proven that there's market fit. The obvious example that's been led by people like Rich and Ethan at July is integrating more and more and more into the supply chain in and of itself. So when you think about your current supply chain, what portion do you own and where's the next obvious steps for Pear over this year and next year to integrate?
It's one thing that we are constantly having conversations of, actually. Because as a startup, you don't really just make a decision for the next 2 years.
No.
You're pretty much making decisions for the next week.
Yeah.
So I couldn't say for this year what we are certain of. It's... as a startup, yeah, even next 2 months is a bit hard to say, but we are working on new products. We have the biggest advantage of owning the supply chain from the yarn.
Okay.
It's something that, you know, most clothing fashion brands would never have an opportunity of.
Yeah.
We develop our own yarns and then we ship the yarns to a maker and then the maker will make our socks. And we are talking to different sock makers at the same time because we are developing new socks right now. So what's coming up next is definitely new socks.
Mm-hmm.
We're going into different sock categories. There will be like kid socks, for example.
Oh,
there will be like professional sports socks.
Nice.
There will be business socks to go with suits. You know, there will be...
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, there will be a few more different types of socks that will come out. And every type of sock requires new techniques to make because we look into every detail of the design. Like for example, the ankle sock or the current socks that we sell, they are designed at a 90 degree angle.
Mm-hmm.
So the heel is a 90 degree, which is unlike normal socks because you've seen normal socks. They are like 120 degrees, right?
Yeah.
When you flat lay them.
Yeah.
Our socks are designed at 90 degrees, just like your heels, which means they will hold your foot in place and almost it's like a snug fit that fits just comfortably right and they don't fall off.
Okay.
So that's actually the secret to our ankle socks not falling off your heels because it's designed at 90 degrees, so it doesn't fall off. And that one design actually requires so much work in the machinery to get it done. It's something that people don't do because most, again, as I said, most socks are designed at 120 degrees because it's most efficient. It saves a lot of money in the cost. It's much cheaper to make.
Yeah.
That's why most factories out there only do that. We need a very special, specific machine just to make our socks.
Yeah, right.
So it's actually much harder for us to find a sock manufacturer.
Do you think over time that you will buy your own manufacturing equipment?
I think we are. We're actually already in conversation to do that.
Right.
Because our socks are just so specific to make.
Yeah.
We have so many unique designs in it that a generic sock maker just can't make it.
Mm. And do you think that for you as a business in the long run, does it make more sense to buy a machine? I don't know if this is even possible, but machines that allow that variation in degrees of things like the ankle versus one that is literally built to only produce in 120 degrees. Do you think that's where things go further for you guys in terms of buying your own equipment?
Yeah, I think we will be buying equipment that can definitely tailor to our needs, that's more specific to our products.
Mm.
And yeah, I guess.
Who's the biggest manufacturer of sock making machines?
Actually, that would be a Rex's question. Sorry. But yeah,
no, because it's
I'm sure it's somewhere in China, though. Like, yeah. We actually talked to so many Australian manufacturers.
Yeah.
And one, they can't make it at a 90-degree angle.
Mm-hmm.
Two, they can't work with our yarns. Because our yarns are also very specific. As I said, it's not cotton, it's not wool. It's a blend. And whenever they take our yarn and they make it into something, it looks just really chunky. They can't really work with our yarn.
Hmm.
It's a very specific thickness that they don't work with.
Yeah.
So we have to talk to like really the top specialists in the industry, in the world, who are in China, who just happen to be, you know, where the supply chain is at. And I guess that's where they have all these different machines that they can test and play around with.
Mm.
And that's how they tailor to our needs and design.
Yeah. So, okay. I can see where things are going. It's sort of obvious that I'm always interested in manufacturing just because my dad's always been in that industry. So, but it's pretty obvious that over time you guys are going to need to develop more and more of that stuff internally and at least own it.
Yeah, definitely.
As opposed to you using service providers.
Yeah, we are definitely thinking of having our own machine and not only to make socks, but also to make the yarns.
Because
right now we're working with the labs.
Okay.
Whereas, again, it's still kind of a third party.
It's still a third party.
Yeah, it's a service. Even though it's like we have a good relationship with the lab.
Yeah.
But still, you know.
And so pick and packing is all done internally, it sounds like.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Because we gave ourselves so much hard time by selling the packs. And people can pick, you know, different colors in the pack. You can get different types of socks in one pack.
Okay.
That means we have to pick
every single one,
put them into one pack and ship them off.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but you know, here we are.
It's good though. It's really exciting. I'm going to be very interested to see where you guys are in 2 years from now, because I think you're definitely onto something. I think the textile component is like your core textile creativity, product creativity from textiles is sort of like your real competitive advantage, and you can see it throughout the supply chain when you speak about the fact that people can only manufacture at 120 degrees.
Mm.
So it's literally going to be, you know, people always talk about tech companies, D2C companies, oh, people can just copy that product. Well, doesn't sound like it's that simple at all.
Yeah, I guess the defensibility of our brand comes from there, right? Like, as I said, the 90 degree is something that most brands out there can't make. And the yarn, the 50-50 blend of wool and cotton is something nobody's making.
Yeah.
Actually, we are the only one.
Well, the fact that you trademarked it or?
Yeah, we trademarked it.
What does that mean? Does that mean that, can someone still make it?
Well, in the textile world, it's a bit blurry. There are blurred lines between these IPs. So even though we trademarked it, I guess if someone developed a way to make it like we did, they can just trademark it with a different name. So
could you patent something like that?
We can't really, because wool and cotton are, you know, they are generic products, materials.
Okay, so
we are sort of just blending the yarns together. And the way to blend it is, there's a bit of secret to it, but it's not something you can really patent,
okay,
I think.
Yeah. Okay, so
we're looking into it, but We're not sure.
I can see in 10 years from now that there being a pair textile lab of sorts. That's
We'll see. One thing I would say is it is really hard. It definitely took
it's
us.
Yeah.
It took the top minds to get the yarn developed.
When you think about what isn't changing in the textile game and the clothing business, yes, you guys are developing new ways of doing things that makes the product more enjoyable, comfortable, whatever your target is for the product, the end product that you're creating. What do you think won't really change over the next couple of years about clothing?
Well, now the trend is going online. I think the online trend is going to stay.
Yeah, yeah.
Personalization is another thing. I think people would always want more options.
Yeah, personalization and online, I'd agree with.
Yeah.
Do you think that, because we've had this really interesting experiment recently with a client who was an alcohol brand.
Mm.
And I've found, even though they've started going direct to consumer, so their majority of their business, like 90% would, 95% would be distribution to household names like Dan Murphy's, you know, bars, clubs, nightclubs, etc.
Mm.
It was one of the few campaigns I've worked with, an e-commerce campaign, where it was sort of obvious to me after the first day or two that this product would never convert online, simply because it is so much easier to just go in store and buy the product, and it's then and there, and it's not something that, unless you can get free delivery or something like that, there's no real advantage for getting it online.
Mm.
So do you think that there are products like that that won't change from offline to online?
I guess from my experience with furniture, I have a feeling that people would always tend to want to see it in a showroom. They would want to sit on a couch, you know, lie on a bed before they actually make a purchase.
Yeah.
I guess those, and it's a really big purchase. So
it is.
That's one of the things. But clothing, you know, we're seeing an online trend more and more often.
Yeah.
It's as long as the sizing's right, you know, you're used to buying off online.
Yeah.
Most people would be.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And I guess that's another reason why we got into socks, because you have a very generic sizing system.
Yeah.
For us, it's just S, M, and L. But to be honest, in reality, we could both probably wear S, M, and L.
Yeah,
it would just stretch a little. And because it's merino wool, it's so stretchy and it stays stretched once you worn a small one.
Yeah.
And, you know, people can just buy it with confidence, knowing that it will fit anyway.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'd agree with that. 100% agree with that.
Yeah.
Before we get into some rapid-fire questions, if you were to think about any entrepreneurial leaders other than Rich and Nathan in the sort of D2C space that you really respect, who would they be?
Well, obviously, I'm a big fan of the Brosser founders.
Yeah.
Ivan and David. Yeah. And Richard, of course. I learned so much from them throughout the years I worked there. I also really enjoyed working with Charles from Love and Money.
Okay.
Yeah. They are a branding design agency. They worked with Pear on our branding.
Yeah, right.
And of course, there are other big players who we all admire. Yeah.
Love and Money, do they specialize in e-com brands or D2C? Or are they just a general branding agency?
They are like a design agency for the digital age.
Okay.
So they work with a lot of websites.
Yeah.
And new brands, I guess.
Okay. I feel like I've heard of that agency a few times now, or someone's mentioned it a few times.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's so many brands I like that I look at, like Allbirds, you know.
Okay.
I love the brand. I own a pair, and it's somewhere I get inspiration from, like the idea of comfort and using natural materials and being sustainable. You know, they are definitely, you know, some brand we look up to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, rapid fire questions to finish things off. Best purchase under $200.
Okay. So I bought these bouldering shoes, rock climbing shoes, that are $160.
Yeah.
Which really got me into trouble with my back pain right now. But They are vegan leather. So it's something I didn't know before. I always thought, you know, the best rock climbing shoes will be real leather or just synthetic fiber. But apparently they got these vegan leather ones that are so soft and comfortable. And again, I think you should always invest in your health.
Okay.
Again, it sounds a bit contradictory right now. It's a bit ironic, but that's what I thought when I bought them.
So what makes leather vegan? What's the name of the textile?
I think in industry, we will call it PU leather. So essentially, it is a type of plastic, I would say.
It's a type of plastic.
I'm assuming.
Because I know the a brand that we have as a client, e-commerce brand, they're called Spencer & Rutherford. They do handbags sort of for the older female demographic, like 40 plus. And that's like a growing segment of their business is vegan leather.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
It's so soft. It's almost like real leather, which is...
You're right.
Yeah, which is great.
But it's plastic.
Yeah, apparently.
There you go. Podcasts. What's been your podcast of choice? Okay. Lately?
So my favorite podcast is this one called The Anthropocene Reviewed.
Okay.
It's by John Green in the States.
Yeah.
And I think they just stopped doing it last year.
Really?
Which is quite a shame. They are definitely my favorite.
So The Anthropocene Reviewed, is this like a sort of historical...
It's an interesting one. He takes one thing from the Anthropocene, which is, you know, something about human that we created or we constructed, and he just goes deep into that one thing or one invention of the human era. Mm-hmm. And he talks about it in a way that, you know, it's not really about the thing. He goes behind the story, he goes through the history of it. He gives you, you know, how it makes you think.
Mm.
Yeah, like for example, I'll just give you one example. Like, for example, there was one episode about Hawaiian pizza.
Okay.
And he talks about globalization. He talks about the Colombian exchange. It talks about, you know, the history of how pineapple ended up as a daily thing on your plate. And it goes through all these, you know, culture and history.
Yeah.
And it loops back into, you know.
I love this stuff because these are just some of the titles of episodes: plagues, mortification, and civilization.
Yeah, I guess I like how it makes you think. Like, you see a very small thing that you might see every day.
Yeah,
like CNN is a good episode as well. It talks about the news channel, but then it goes behind it. It talks about our emotional reaction or, you know, our touches tied to it.
Well, here's an episode. John Green reviews the QWERTY keyboard layout and the bird species called... is it Kawaii-o? Kawaii-o? Something like that.
Yeah.
It looks like a Polynesian sort of writing. It's very interesting. I have gone deep on a similar channel, but it's more geopolitical related, and it's totally fascinating to me. And you can get really... find that I get lost in these sort of things.
Yeah.
Do you like, have you ever listened to Hardcore History?
No, I haven't. Is it called Hardcore History?
Hardcore History is like another good example of this, but this guy's channel is called What If All This? And it's just about what if scenarios.
Oh.
Like what if there was what if there was an American Civil War? What if America was like a bunch of medieval countries, all these sort of ideas. What if there was a world war now? What if these countries, like, it's more obviously geopolitical focus.
Yep.
But it's super fascinating. And my favorite book ever is Homo Sapiens. I like anything with like a historical perspective.
Yeah.
I think.
I quite like that book as well.
Yeah.
So I guess you would definitely like the Anthropocene Reviewed.
Yeah.
It's also interesting because I follow a YouTube channel called What If. It's more of a scientific what if. It's like, what if you fall into a black hole?
Okay.
Yeah, something like, what if you surf a tsunami? That kind of what if, but yeah. It's also similar to what you just said.
Yeah, that's super fascinating.
Yeah.
All right, last question for you. If you were to pick a quote, what would it be and why?
Okay. I really like this quote and I almost live by it. It's by Oscar Wilde. He said, "To define is to limit." And I guess that's yeah, something I truly believe in, and constantly trying to align myself with that. Like, mm-hmm. always be outside the box. Never try to limit yourself by saying this is this, that is that. You know, like, same with socks. You know, you can say, okay, a sock is designed with cotton. It always has to be 120 degrees. That's what a sock is.
Okay.
And I would just go, no.
Do you listen to Naval much, Naval Ravikant? He's sort of like a really prominent VC angel investor. And he said a similar thing. It's like you shouldn't define things by category. You should define yourself by less categories as possible.
Yeah.
You know, like political beliefs, economic beliefs, whatever it may be.
I'll totally agree with that. I think that's where creativity comes from.
Yeah.
It comes from you think something is not what it is. It can be done in a different way.
Yeah.
And but the moment you define something, you are limiting its possibilities.
Mm.
And I would always try to, you know, not do that.
Yeah. Nathan, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Where can people find you and Pear on the internet?
Okay, it is pear.com.au. It's okay. Pear with an E. So P-A-I-R-E .com.au.
Yep. And where are you best located on social media?
Myself, I'm on Instagram, NY1K.
NY1K. Nice. It's a good handle.
Small one.
NY1K. If people want to check out the mystery socks,
yeah,
here's the packaging. I do like this packaging. check it out. Go have a look. Let us know what you think. I think I'll be trying some later on.
Mm. So if you go onto our website, you scroll down to the bottom, there's a little section where you can send a text to any friend or family of yours. We'll send a text for you. Your friend or family will get a mystery sock. And you will get one immediately in your shopping bag as well.
Wow. That's sick. Nathan, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much for checking out this episode. If you do like it, please subscribe. And of course, like if you're watching the YouTube video as well. We'd really appreciate that. You can also find our Clips channel in the description. For audio, if you're not already listening, you can search Uncommon on Pocket Cast, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts quite easily. For video, if you're not watching, you can search Uncommon on YouTube. And for behind the scenes takes and clips on social media, then definitely check out at Uncommon_show on Instagram. But otherwise, look, thanks so much for tuning in. And until next time, thanks for listening.